years before I went into academe, and I worked at 10 commercial radio stations. So public broadcasting was really kind of the other world, you know, to us. And of course, back at the time I was in radio, commercial radio had the dominant film. I mean, it had, you know, the most number of radio listeners were tuned to commercial radio.
Right. Right. Otis, are you there, ma'am? How are you doing, Kenny? Are you there, Otis?
Hello. Good morning.
Morning, Ken. Otis, are you there? Adele, welcome, Adele. Let me just...
Excuse me, Jim, are you recording?
We are going to record. You don't mind that, Michael, do you? If we record it? No, okay. I'm going to get started in a minute. People will come in. What we'll do, of course, Michael, is I'll be very brief. I'll be very brief. Thank you, Otis. You're here. And basically, we'll have everybody come and ask questions and have a discussion.
Yeah, okay.
So. You know, rather than to do anything more fancy. I'll do a little bit of an introduction for you, but let me just get this up here. Otis, I'm ready to start if you're ready to start. Okay, very good. All right, well, let me start. This is a meeting of the Pacifica Foundation Technology Task Force. My name is Jim Dingman. I'm one of the members. And we're very pleased today to have Professor Emeritus Michael Keith of Boston College. I'm just throwing up for those who are participating, but I'm going to just read a little bit of this. You know, this standard kind of, you know, presentation when you have an academic be in front of a panel. Professor Michael Keith taught at Boston College for several decades. He was the visiting professor at George Washington Marquette, director of telecommunications at Dean College. He has produced many different works, and let me get to them because that's what really is fascinating for us to listen to. Not only is he a novelist, which he can talk about, but Michael has produced a whole variety of books on radio, and in particular, what drew me to my attention to Michael years ago was his textbook on the radio station, which was sort of used in all sorts of different telecommunications classes around the United States. But just to give you a little sense of the broadness of his writing, he's done a work on Norman Corwin. Norman Corwin, of course, is the great radio artist of the golden age of radio, and someone who always is one we look forward to listen to. He's also written a lot about wide diversity of issues in radio, sex and indecency, gay and lesbian broadcasting, Native American broadcasting, and in particular, books that focus in on the practicalities of programming, which is very important. We're very pleased to have Michael here today with us to talk with us. I'm going to be extremely brief. I'm going to just ask questions. I want everybody else to participate. We're not here to have a mono session here. We really want to have a discussion. The purpose of the technology task force is pretty broad. We're to think about not only the impact of new technology on radio, but obviously it has totally upset in the past 20 years the concepts of what we think of traditionally as radio. And, of course, talking about podcasting. I'm talking about digital technology. And, Michael, I just wanted you to, first of all, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And could you just give your initially some of your thoughts about where we're at and where we're going in terms of radio? Is it going to be a multi-media type platform? What do you think?
Well, that's a $24 question, I guess. I'm a little concerned about broadcast radio and the future of broadcast radio. I know that it has suffered a decline in its listenership over the last couple of decades. I think the online audio streaming systems or channels that are out there have seriously eroded the audience for broadcast radio. Despite what I read that radio still attracts 92% of the listening audience a week, I have real trouble believing that. I can't imagine the medium attracting more than 30 or 40% of viewers under the age of 30. If it is, I don't know who they are. I still teach a course every semester at Boston College. I teach the history of broadcasting. And I always take a survey of my students who are, you know, anywhere from 19 to 21 or 22. And I ask them, who listens to radio with any kind of regularity? Not just maybe once a month by accident or when they're in their parents' car, but who listens? And 5, 6, 7 years ago, maybe out of a class of 15 students, 2 or 3 would indicate that they do. In recent semesters, in the last couple of years, no one's listening in that. And I think they're pretty representative of their demographic. They're not listening. They're streaming. They have all of their devices. And radio is just an antiquated form of audio for them. It's surprising how ignorant they are of what radio is or what radio was. They just don't know anything about it because in their short lifetimes, they haven't used it. You know, they know about it perhaps because their parents are listening to Pacifica or public radio. The last real listening I did on radio was to public radio. I don't listen to commercial or mainstream radio anymore. I felt like a turncoat actually because I have Sirius satellite in my car and I'm pretty married to it. I listen to all manner of programming that Sirius offers. I'm hooked on radio dramas. Of course, there's where Norman Corwin comes in. But of course, I'm not writing about radio as I did a few years ago. Then I felt compelled to be tuned in to both commercial and public radio. I felt I can't be writing about it if I don't know what's there, if I'm not listening. But I don't do that anymore. I haven't written... I think the Norman Corwin book was the last book I was involved in, and that was, I'm losing track of time. That's what happens when you get in your 70s. And that was maybe 7, 8, 9, maybe even 10 years ago. As you had mentioned, Jim, I spend my retirement writing time writing fiction. And it's more avocational, more distraction, more of a hobby sort of thing. So getting back to what your initial question was, what about radio? What about radio's future? I think radio will always be around, but I think the form of radio that'll probably always be around will be some form of public radio. I think music radio is dead. Who's listening to music on radio? I mean, there's always somebody, but certainly, not people under 40 or people under 30. I mean, music used to be the principal reason people tuned radio. Radio lost the number one reason people came to it. And then that lapsed over into talk radio. And that was principally a programming format on AM radio. So what's going to happen in the future? I don't have my crystal ball here, but my sense is that it'll become more and more splintered, more and more fragmented. You know, radio used to be the dominant store on the listening mall. Now it's one of the, the boutiques on there, on the mall. And we know what's happened to malls anyway. You know, so, I hate to be a doom and gloom or naysayer, about radio. And, you know, I mean, there may be a form of highly original radio programming that comes down the pike. But, of course, that can transfer over and to Internet streaming in a nanosecond. We have podcasting, which I always chuckle about podcasting because the people who are discovering podcasting think it's something that's never existed before. Podcasting is just a radio recording or a live feature. It's, you know, I mean, this has been out there since the inception of radio features, audio features, except now it's accessible online. Anybody can have a podcast, which back in the major day of radio, not everybody could have radio. You know, you had to have big bucks and a FCC license, and then you could have radio. But the idea of people going back to radio, that's a real stretch. You know, people left radio because there was more variety elsewhere. People left radio because there were no commercials, and I'm speaking of commercial radio. People left radio and commercial radio again because there wasn't the redundancy and there was greater variety. So who would give all of that stuff up to go back to mainstream radio? I don't know. I'm sure that this doesn't fully address your question, but you know, you probably have to put a clamp on me. I'll talk for a long time on this thing, but I see you have other folks here who might want to get in on this.
Well, trust me, you've got a lot of people who have always don't have clamps on themselves on this phone call. I guess I just want to unclamp myself just one more. You know, I also am amused when I've gone to these podcasting conferences, in New York City. I've gone to a whole bunch of them, both commercial and in the academy. And you're right. It's sort of amazing because they think they've discovered something new. And I sort of laugh because you talk about Norman Corwin and they talk about the need for produced radio and produced sort of, and I am also great. I know we have a few people on this phone call, great fans of radio drama. And I laugh because, you know, they're essentially recreating with podcasts some of the best characteristics of broadcast radio.
And the fact is too, there's literally thousands of radio recordings, from the last 100 years or from the golden age of radio. So nothing really new is being done that hasn't been done in one form or another over the last, seven decades of radio.
Right. And I'm wondering, you know, since part of our task here is to talk about technology, what do you think about the digital revolution? What's your thoughts about what's been going on now for the past 30 years?
Well, I don't have anything against it. I use it all the time. So, even though I was a lover of radio, of old line analog radio, when digital streaming came along, I engaged in it, you know, right away. So I think it has stepped things up in terms of certainly the quality and the durability and the options in the audio arena.
All right. Well, we're talking with Professor Emeritus Michael Keith of Boston College. He's the author of numerous books on radio production. He's a novelist. His book, The Radio Station, is a standard text throughout the country in teaching radio. And as I understand it from your folks who took over the book from you, they're trying now to orient it internationally because the decline in radio production or interest in classes in the United States.
Yeah.
Again, focused on the international aspects of it. But let me first bring in one of my fellow partners in crime here, Mr. McClay. Otis, jump in here.
All right. Let me jump in and get rid of the background noise. Okay. One of the things that you can't do on a podcast is phone calls. And I have to, you know, say that, well, I think Pacifica pretty much invented phone calls. maybe at WBAI in New York, maybe Bob Fass and, what's his name? I can't think of him, the great gay programmer.
Steve Post.
Yeah, Steve. No, I wasn't thinking of him, and I'll think of his name in a minute, but so you, I'm just wondering where that fits in, because podcasts are, you know, just, they're just recordings, as you pointed out. And the one thing that radio has, particularly the actual, now they've got the stream, so there isn't, now they have the signal, so there isn't a delay if you're doing digital. That, well, you need the delay, actually, I'm sorry. That's one thing that you can't do in a podcast, and it's actually kind of hard to do on a stream. You can do it. And I'm wondering about that. What happens to that synchronicity, that real-time characteristic of radio? Because radio is the most real-time medium. Any hope? Or is that just dead?
No, I think you have a good point there about radio being the real-time medium. I don't know if people care about that. You know, maybe they should care about that, but I'm not sure about the relationship between the general audience and audio. You know, they look for diversity. They look for options. They look for something that doesn't violate their personal aesthetics when it comes to dealing with commercials and repetition and idiots, I suppose. But I don't know that, you know, technology's been a great thing, and I always admired the engineers in my life. You know, I always envied their knowledge and their skill because I'm not an engineer. I was a radio producer. I could go into production room, and I did for many years, and I could produce commercials and anything else that needed to be mixed with, you know, back in my day, you know, we had reel-to-reel machines, you know, and analog consoles and cart machines, you know, all of that,
Do you miss the razor blade?
I do. I was, I had a great, you know, I was a good razor. I'll tell you, I could slice a half a breath out of something. But right. That's a lost art. That's gone. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you about 10 years ago when I went to Boston College almost 30 years ago, my job was to teach radio production. And we had a few little audio booths that were horrible. I mean, they had ancient machines in those rooms. And I was appalled considering what BC was getting for tuition, why they didn't have more state-of-the-art. But unfortunately, the people who had done this before me, they didn't have a background in radio. They didn't have a background in equipment. They just took anything that they, you know, it was left out in the alley. When I got there, I shook things up and I said, this is unacceptable, you know. But then once they beefed up the studios, I could see that there was a whole new generation in audio equipment coming in, digital equipment, that I hadn't dealt with. I hadn't dealt with digital editing. You know, I was the razor guy and so much of the other stuff. And so I shifted my teaching orientation toward history and sociology. And so I ended up teaching the history of media and the sociology of media and sociology of radio. And I started writing books in those areas, which had been, interestingly enough, neglected. There hadn't been a real field of radio studies, and I'm talking 80s and 90s, that there hadn't been books that examined the significant role of radio in American society. There, what books were out there were always, you know, nostalgia books, you know, Amos and Andy, back in the old golden days of radio. But what about the impact radio had in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s? Significant. you know, in the 1980s, talk radio took over, and, you know, and it put Republicans in office because of the power of talk radio on AM. So I moved away from the technical side, if you want to call it that. The equipment side is what I would call it.
Bruce, you wanted to ask something? Bruce, you want to unmute?
Yeah, can you hear me? Okay, I just want to add, two comments, and they're probably more from, I mean, I'm not a radio guy. I've been listening to BAI for about 7 years, and I've been more involved the last 2 years. But there's a whole community aspect to radio that doesn't depend on the equipment. And WBAI, for instance, has probably 5 or 6...
Can he boost the sound, please? I can't hear.
Oh, BAI has like 5, 6, 7 shows that have heavy call-in. They're very popular. They have no social media presence, and basically you know because you know. There's On the Count, which is a prison show, and it's got a huge audience. There's A New Day, which is a morning show, and they've got a huge audience. And Bob Law, who's been broadcasting for many years, and he doesn't even kind of need to do any outreach because everybody knows him. And you get this interaction between the listeners and the host and the other listeners, and it's really important. And I think actually at BAI, the call-in shows are the most popular shows. The second point, which is totally different, is now with the technology, anybody can start a radio station. I looked at Houston. Houston has 61 over-the-air stations and 144 internet radio streaming stations. So basically, you get a MacBook, you have a radio station. So it lowered the barrier of entry. You don't need an FCC license. You don't need an LPFM license. You just hook up with Stream Guys or whatever, and you have a radio station. So anybody and everybody can broadcast. The problem with that is if you look at it, the content, it's pretty much all the same stuff, and pretty bad radio, to tell you the truth. I'm done. That's it.
There's a lot of internet radio out there. I don't even know that it deserves the term radio. I think it's just another audio source. I guess I'm old school because radio to me, again, and I am old school, is broadcasting. And that's kind of what we're talking about. I think all of the streaming audio services are what's detracting or what's drawing audiences away from standard over-the-air broadcasting.
Yeah, but I gotta say, because this is what I do at Pacifica, but we stream the signal. And
right.
We just have kind of figured it's 10 to 1, that if I can see how many people are on the stream, I'm going to have 10 times that many listening to the signal. In general, that seems to be more or less accurate. So
yeah, that
the stream really helps. I live outside Austin now, and the signal from KUT is kind of wifty where I am. So I listen to it on the stream. And I think a lot of people do that also, and you could do it in a car now.
I suppose it breaks down to demographics, breaks down to age groups. I mean, I don't know what BAI's demographics are, but I would imagine they skew adult, older adult. I'm sure there's probably a couple of programs here that might have a younger audience, you know. But I think as we talk about the future of radio, broadcast radio is not going to survive unless it gets its youth back, or it's going to be reduced. Instead of 10,000 radio stations, there'll be 1,000 radio stations across the country. And maybe that's okay. Maybe there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it all comes down to programming, programming, programming. If there's something worthwhile to listen to, people will find it. unfortunately, in commercial radio in particular, there wasn't a lot that was worth listening to. You know, there were exceptions. You mentioned, I think, Otis, maybe it wasn't you, community radio, you know. I think radio, broadcast radio that has a strong community identity and a strong community involvement can expect to stay healthier longer, you know. But you don't find a lot of broadcast radio stations, with the exception of public radio, commercial stations, which still outnumber public broadcast stations substantially. Yeah. So, but you don't find that over there. And maybe something that is one of the problems. You don't find a lot of commercial broadcasters that are thinking of ways to innovate to return people. You know, they're up against a tough situation. They survive off of advertising, you know, and advertising has dwindled so substantially to mainstream broadcasting and commercial radio that these stations, I don't know how many stations went silent last year, but thousands of stations have gone silent since the late 1990s.
But you know, one of the interesting things that we never talk about really are the local mom and pop stations, which do have strong community involvement. Generally, they're commercial stations. So I don't know what's happening with them, whether they're getting those local ads that they depend on, you know, green sheet stuff.
I think and their audience
is really important, and we don't hear about them in the urban centers.
But if I may, I you're right. The local small market stations, because they're more like a small market newspaper, which of course is also going dead.
Right.
And that doesn't really help us in the big cities. You know, I guess by way of disclaimer, I'm out in LA, I listen to KPFK and a dozen other things, and I'm running for local station board. And one of the challenges, which some, you know, they go, we need more money, we need more money, we're tired of fund drives, get more listeners. Did you get more listeners? Well, the listeners are not the people that are listening to the bloody thing now. And what you both said, go to that, but, listening to what you've been saying, a couple of things come to mind. In the early days of MTV, I forget who it was, maybe somebody who's more attuned to that than I am will remember the song Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah, but remember, the first video.
Right, but remember, radio was going to kill the theater in vaudeville, and TV was going to kill radio. And now streaming services are going to kill TV. But if you look where the technology part of that is, in the TV world, there are still people, and or compare the programming. Sports, things that are rights related, which a community station just can't get into, but it's news talk, it's sports, and things of that nature. When you look at where people are listening in the last sort of tail end of my career in the home products world, I did deals. I worked at Harman for way too long. And we were one of the first, or we wanted to be one of the first to get XM. It was before they merged into a Harman Kardon AVR. And that's where Sirius and now Sirius XM first started to get it into home products. And they realized that wasn't the answer. It was cars. If you look at HD radio, which I'm a big fan of, and I'm going to go down screaming to try and get at least KPFK or Pacifica into HD radio so they can get more streams. But if I talk to the people at Ubiquiti or now at Xperi, it's all in cars. I couldn't get modules for a home product because nobody's doing it anymore except for the stuff that I invented. So the where you listen is one thing. The call-ins are important. It can be done, but you can't walk and talk technically at the same time. And then I'll flip it over one more time. where the listenership is important, I think if you compare the demographics to the technology, I'll bet that there are more underserved communities that listen to radio, which is something that community radio needs to get involved in. If there is more space for underserved communities, they will more likely listen to radio because they can't afford the cost of the streaming services. And yet there's another nexus to that. If you listen to the Dodger radio broadcast, it used to be, this is, where the hell are they on? I don't even remember. Whatever, it used to be KFWB years ago. Listen to, this is KFWB Los Angeles and the LA Dodgers radio network. But they don't say the LA Dodgers radio network, and besides, KFWB went Spanish. Now they say on the Dodgers audio network, or you listen to anybody's legal ID on any station, and they're saying, listen to us on whatever their call letters and station are, or listen to our stream, or tell your smart speaker, the NPR does this, tell your smart speaker to play whatever the heck it is, and we've got to find the right, you know, interfaces to that. Now, one last thing that goes to what Michael is saying is one of the most popular things, at least that I'm seeing on Sirius XM, is somebody bought the rights to these old Lucille Ball interviews, which are from before old, and yet that's suddenly become popular. It's a mix of talk and some old person doing talk, a dead person doing talk radio to talk people that young people are listening to in their cars over a satellite delivered service.
You know, they say we live in a post-literate generation. They say, right? They say the people aren't reading anymore. Maybe in our demographic here, but young people are not reading anymore. I've confirmed that in my own little intimate surveys in class, that they're not reading books. Or maybe I should say they're not reading literature, you know, maybe a how-to book here and there or whatnot. But I discovered they're not listening either. They're listening to music, niche music streaming and the buds in their ears, but they don't care about, the rest of them. Now, I'm focusing mostly on people under 25, you know, which is the audience radio, broadcast radio's lost that audience. It's, you know, it's gone, but, it's a real trial for me to get to get students to listen to programs, legendary programs from radio's golden age. They've lost the capacity to listen. They drift off. They're gone in no time at all. Years ago, I was naive to think that they would listen to Archibald MacLeish's Fall of the City, which was a classic radio drama from the late 1930s or 1940s. And within 5 minutes, eyes had glazed over. They just were not with me anymore. I had them listen to some of Norman Corwin's programs, pretty much, you know, the same thing. They're just not acclimated to listening to content that has, you know, they call radio the theater of the mind, back then. Yeah, it's not so much a theater. I'm sorry, Ken, somebody's talking.
Ken, you're echoing.
Oh, is that me echoing?
No. It's Ken.
No, it's Ken.
Anyway.
Okay.
Come the thundering hoofbeats.
Well, one thing I wanted to interject, Michael, as others come into this discussion, is I want to just give you an outline, quickly of the actual listenership in the stations in Pacifica. The station in, California has about 60 to 70,000 people as a cum a week. The station in, Los Angeles fluctuates between 50 and 80,000. The station in New York fluctuates between 50 and 80,000. The station in Washington, I think it's around 60,000. The station in Houston is about 15 to 25,000. So that number is, as I mentioned, about 65 to 70% less than what it was in 2000. And what another aspect of that is that the P1 characteristics of the listenership are extremely high. So, for example, when I first started to look at the Nielsen's and Arbitrons at BAI back in the early 90s, we had a hard core of about 15%. That would be what they listen to all the time is BAI. It's increased to about 40%, and my inference from that is that it's more of a siloized kind of listenership at this point, at least in New York. Now, the question that was raised earlier, Bruce raised the question of how many people are listening to some of these shows. What we find in New York is the music shows have incredibly – actually, their AQH is far higher than the talk shows. And that the issue of the interaction of the talk shows is very important, but we're still only getting about 1,000 to 2,000 at the most, maybe with these talk shows he's referring to. And Amy Goodman, when she comes in the morning, she's a national strip show. She gets about 4,000 in different market areas. It's very high with public affairs. In Berkeley, it's almost like 14 to 20,000 an hour, whereas in New York, it's about a quarter of that. So that's a sort of like broad picture. Now, the other issue that's raised here is how do we then take and I totally agree with you about the Generation Zs, because, you know, whenever I deal with kids, they don't listen to radio. They're listening to their devices. My son, he thinks we're a bunch of morons. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing I get. And so how do we get to the issue of taking the podcast forms or these multimedia forms and doing the kind of things that people here are interested in? I don't know if you're looking at the chat, but, and Nancy, you come on in here. But the whole question is how do we, take these new forms and innovate them and synthesize them into the analog? How do we make it more interesting? And you're right, programming is king. I don't care how innovative people think they are. If the thing that people are listening to stinks, you're not going to get people coming. And so people have to confront that. But anyway, let me shut up right now. Nancy, I see you're sitting there burning the chat. You want to jump in here? Okay, I guess not yet. Nancy, go on.
No. You're right. We have to do something different, you know, otherwise we're going to lose it. And we're always going to need radio. So I think we have to roll up our sleeves and get the kids' voices on the air, the people's voices on the air, and address their dire needs and concerns, which is considered radical. And I think we're falling into NPR light, and we're not really concentrating on radical. And that's where we would be different.
I think the idea of radio as a mass medium, radio as we know it, is no longer relevant. I think radio, again, as I said initially, I think it's just one more flavor on the menu, and if that flavor if the flavor is something people want, they're going to order it. And like Nancy said, yeah, you got to innovate something that you know that the audience want. Every day, new audio services, you know, there are new streaming services, and it's really hard to stand out and to define yourselves. What you're talking about, Jim, in terms of QM, you ain't going to have that 5 years from now. You're not going to have it 10 years from now. I think radio share that it has now is going to continue to shrink. I don't see anything that suggests that it's going to hold fast or that it's going to increase because of all of the new emerging streaming services and the popularity of the streaming services that exist right now. I think it's almost at the point where media, audio media that have enjoyed substantial shares, if you will, have to come to terms with the fact that they're going to be nichers too. And that's a hard pill to swallow, because at one time, radio broadcasters owned the dial. As they said, they were the only game in town. That's a bygone age.
Go on.
I apologize. It's also a use case problem. Again, as I mentioned, I live in LA, and when the walls start to shake, what's the first thing you do? Turn on the radio to see if there was an earthquake. If you're driving down the 405, and even though I've got, you know, the traffic maps in my car and all that business, but if I want to know if there's a SIG alert, you know, on Venice Boulevard or wherever the heck it is, I'm going to turn on the radio because I'm going to get a reliable traffic report, you know, every X hour.
Michael, you're going to turn that on because you are who you are and you're at the age you are.
No, I'm 71 years old
in an hour now.
And I probably use some of your books. I don't know, that would age you, and I don't want to do that. When I went to Ithaca College 50 years ago, but I've got a textbook on radio from when my mother, who's now 94, went to Brooklyn College in I'm not allowed to say when, it's a state guarded secret, but you know, a precursor to what you did is a radio textbook. But the medium needs to adapt to the audience. And if we live in a short attention span, radio's always been short attention span, the golden age aside, there's a reason why the audience measurements are done in quarter hour segments, because they know that that's how people listen to, finger quotes, radio. So as public broadcasters, how do we find the programming that fits into the right day part to attract the right audience? And hopefully it's not a bunch of, I hesitate to say, folks like ourselves. When my son is down here, and that's probably why I got to leave shorter than I would want to. He's down here to celebrate his 35th birthday, and he borrowed our car last night. And what's on the radio? Music. And he didn't connect his phone. He didn't, God help us, he didn't put his earbuds in. And we need to also not only catch a mobile audience, if that's possible, but to catch a short attention span audience and an ethnic audience. And again, I speak to LA, where there are gazillions of underserved from a language and cultural standpoint, not the usual minorities. And I don't mean to offend anyone by that, but all the underserved people that are looking for information and content in their language or in line with their way of thoughts, that it's not being provided. And radio has the ability to do that, because a lot of those communities don't have the ability or the knowledge or the time to produce a podcast. If they could come down to the radio station and do a half hour a week addressing that particular age, ethnic, language, belief, whatever demo, that's where you might be able to take advantage of radio. Or you go back to Stan Freeberg and the maraschino cherry rolling down the hill.
There's no magic bullet, I think.
Sure.
Good programming will always attract a segment of the audience, but the segment of the audience that broadcasters have enjoyed in the past is going to be so fractionalized, or it's going to be so narrowed, that it's going to be a question of where are you, what you're doing, what's your position. And we have to, I'm not in it anymore, But people who are in broadcasting or in radio now have to accept that it's just a multifaceted arena out there, and whatever, you know, whatever you can do that somehow allows you to stand out a little bit is going to help. But it's ferocious. It's very, very fierce. Like I say, I don't want to seem like a doom and gloom guy, but I see radio broadcasting dwindling and continuing to dwindle in the years ahead, even with outstanding programming found in public radio and in Pacifica, which I think is extraordinary. The audience has just reoriented its compass, and I don't know what to do about that.
Jim, if I may?
Yeah,
Tom. Hi, thanks, gentlemen, for all this wonderful food for thought. I wanted to ask Michael, I was a few minutes late, and he was going through a list of, what did he call it? Well, diversity options. Some of the things that people who are consuming media today are looking for that radio doesn't meet. But first, let me make a couple of observations. I'm a social studies high school history teacher by trade. I worked in media, video, and a small PR firm here in D.C. for a good while before becoming a teacher. But I just remember... so I'm around high school kids a lot too. The old have complained about the youth every generation for centuries. Bear that in mind. There's always something they're doing wrong, and that's fine. You know, that's, it's an age old thing. 25 year olds don't necessarily do what 30, but when they turn 35, maybe they start consuming something different. That's also a distinct possibility. As we age, we, our tastes, don't necessarily expand. They're honed, and we look for, things that, as you said, meet our moral presuppositions, our either limited or provincial versus cosmopolitan tastes, et cetera. Bemoaning the decline of radio, market segmentation has been happening, and driven not by, obviously, public radio, really, but by commercial radio when it was advantageous for, capitalist corporations to buy massive ads on radio, you know, that's because they could sell at a mass market. They and their advertisers recognize the segmentation that has occurred, which is, I guess, is, you know, partly sociological, but they've also forced the media to adapt to that. Have they not? Could you say that? Social media emerged, the internet emerged as ways to reach, to both segment the market, and to take advantage of the same segmentation they were perpetrating. We in live radio, I guess, you know, one of our strengths, as has been said, is, immediacy, live call-ins, all those sorts of things. What we have trouble with maybe is distribution, given that the audience doesn't consume it in the car or at home. Maybe walking to the bus or in the metro or heaven knows while they're on a job somewhere. I'm just throwing out some spitballing a few things. I remember someone made a point of WBAI appointment shows. Would you call Gary Null one of those? Because I certainly would. That's just an outlying question. And whatever happened to micropower and the movement, you know, I remember reading more, and you all probably experienced it, but I remember Alex Coburn and, you know, Counterpunch sort of defending these, basically the FCC's attempt to stop the licensure of small power radio, and they were seen as somehow unfair or unregulated competition. I'm not really sure all the issues. How are those going? Or as you say, is it now just so much easier with a laptop to create your internet station? And of course, with micropower, just like the internet, you know, you still have to program. you know, just because you have that some technology doesn't mean you can do anything more than a couple hours of quality anything for, you know, a week, unless you want to just spin records or whatever. I mean, there are some people that, you know, have a lot to say, but even they have to become, have to produce stuff. I heard Bill Maher say the other day, and I don't even know why I watch it anymore, but he claimed the youth have either a 5-second attention span or they can listen to a podcast for 4 hours. I think that's, I draw the line because I listen to podcasts, but I certainly don't spend 4 hours and I'll come back to it. It's like a book or something like that. That sort of distribution of media, we should be able to recognize and we can accommodate it, but, I don't know. I just think I hear a lot of chicken, the sky is falling, and at the same time, you know, these are natural evolutions of, well, not even natural. It is capitalism after all that's driving this stuff. I mean, how do consumer product companies sell goods anymore? Not that we're part of that world, but radio, you know, the big boys, that is their world. So, you know, if anyone want to comment, I'll be happy to.
Well, they've gone to YouTube and a lot of other places. They've taken the advertising off of radio, which has experienced such a diminishment of audience, and they found other, you know, the internet has subsumed everything, and we just have to accept that we have to find our role in that universe, which has expanded exponentially. You know, we're not just a planet anymore; we're a galaxy of audio, where, you know, how do we exist? How do we survive in it? Is a question I guess everybody's thinking about.
Well, I'm just curious, you know, one thing that, that Thomas raises that, in his comment and question to you is, you know, what are the elements of good radio? What is good radio? What is good broadcasting? I mean, when you're teaching this to kids over the past, couple of decades, what sort of things are you stressing? And one thing that comes to mind is that, you know, in New York, we have this pop-up pirate operation called the Montez Press. And what these guys do is every year they essentially do 4 days of, frankly, the kind of programming Pacifica hasn't done in 50 years. They basically get on the air. They'll play, for example, 5 hours of lectures of Freud. They'll play experimental music. They'll play things that are directed towards the artistic community in New York City. And then in Brooklyn, there are 35 pirate radio stations operating in Brooklyn alone, in New York City, that compete with our signal. So some things that come to mind is, you know, getting back to this question of quality, what did you emphasize? What do you see as the ingredients to produce quality broadcasting?
Innovation, well-produced, relevance. What does it mean? Pertinence. Who is it directed to? You know, all of those elements, all of those ingredients, will attract listeners. It depends on what your medium is. It's really hard again to get people who have lived in a world that's been internet exclusive to understand the qualities that radio can provide when radio, for the most part, is not providing those qualities or is not relevant to their world. I look at radio in general for the 18-year-old, and I don't find much there that would attract an 18-year-old. Not on Pacifica, not on public radio, and not on commercial radio. They're somewhere else in time. Their behavior and their habits are different than what radio saw as as the profile of its listener. So I think there's a lot of, I think there needs to be a lot of re-education, not only on the part of broadcasters, but on the part of potential listeners. How do you draw? How do you get? I mean, if radio, broadcast radio, is not cultivating an appreciation of itself in young people under 30, it's dead. It's dead. There'll be nobody to listen to radio in 20 years from now. I mean, where are they going to come from? I think they're just, you know, it sounds prosaic, but there just has to be good, interesting programming, and somehow people who might appreciate it need to be made aware of it and steered in the direction of it. That's a really hard problem when there's 50,000 audio options that exists out there. I don't know how you do that. You know, there's something for every little niche, you know, micro niche taste. So how do you do? I mean, you're still operating a mass medium. You're still trying to reach a mass audience. I don't know. I mean, there's no, I mean, mass media. I think at my university that has a course in mass media, in our meetings, I say, you know, there is no mass media anymore. It's all, you should be teaching niche media, micro media. That's what's out there. Now, some of the niche media have larger audiences than other niche media. But by comparison to the days of old, it's still a pretty nominal amount of people. That's fluid. That changes almost, you know, overnight.
Yeah. Before you jump in, Otis, and let me just ask if Ken or Richard want to come in on this. Well, sometimes I think that what we should be doing is also building up the ability to teach people how to YouTube stream. Basically, because that's where music is listened to now, overwhelmingly, is YouTube. And basically, you know, have a community part of that. If somebody wants to come in and learn podcasting, well, podcasting to me is essentially learning how to do good radio. I mean, the elements of good radio, the kind of things you stressed in there, because it brings to mind one of the former program directors of BAI and who also ran KPFA for a while. He used to teach sound design at NYU Film School. And he was teaching it at a time when you could do the razor cutting. So he would insist that for the first semester, the students create essentially analog cut sound projects, because he wanted them to have the physical experience of actually cutting and pasting and cutting and pasting. And then he transitioned to the digital. Now, of course, digital editing tools are the main thing. But the point there was to, how do you then open this up to have people come in and then learn skills? And that's where I think one of the weaknesses of Pacifica, from my perspective, they don't have enough skill building built into their systems and their stations that essentially attract. But let me, Otis, you wanted to say something there?
Yeah, Michael said it. I was just going to say that, you know, there was a time, it has to do with the number, you know, gatekeepers and the number of gates. There was a time when, I guess it was Tuesday night, I don't know because I didn't watch it, but when Lucy was on, you could walk down a street and see the TV flickering in every single house. And there was this commonality of experience among a very broad swath of people. Same thing about the news and so forth. And that's completely splintered now. So that,
yeah, there's no longer any water cooler chats.
Right.
Everybody's in their own little universe.
The issue becomes marketing. I mean, the issue becomes, as you said, Michael,
right.
How do you tell somebody that you got, you know, you got some great shit here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things in my broadcast history courses, I do try to point them in the direction of good programming. And it's like, to use an old remedy metaphor, it's like giving them castor oil. And I assign it. I mean, to pass the course, they have to do certain things that I assign. So they do have to listen to BAI, or they do have to listen to This American Life, or they do have to listen to Fresh Air, or you know, and things like this. And when they do, I'm encouraged a lot of times, because it's almost like an epiphany to them. It's almost like a discovery. They say, oh, that's pretty good. I kind of like that, you know. Now, I don't know how many of them continue to listen to it, but my sense is that in the world where there's so many skillions of options, that a lot of what you do gets lost. And young people, I mean, young people have never heard of Pacifica Radio. Young people, I mean, young people have not heard of NPR. I mean, they don't know what is over there. It's a rarity. But when they do hear of certain things that maybe have some relevance to them, that they're not closed-minded to it, and they'll appreciate it, but there's so much distraction and they're drawn away from it. So that's, you know, that's a really, really challenging issue to do the good work. I mean, the wonderful product that BAI, Pacific Radio, I've always been a fan of Pacific Radio and NPR, public broadcasting, BBC and all of that and whatnot. But, it's being lost in the dust storm of new and emerging digital technologies. And it obscures things, and they don't, you know, unless you somehow are successful in convincing them that it will benefit them, they're indifferent to it. They're satisfied with what they have, you know, and that's true of other, as you indicated, other media as well. BC got to the point, Boston College, that it was every day it had, had the New York Times stacks of them put in dormitory lobbies and in classroom buildings in the hope that students would maybe pick up the, you know, the New York Times or the Boston Globe. And after a couple of years doing that, they stopped, because those same piles were pretty much there at the end of the day. The student interest wasn't there. They didn't want to read. They wanted to get on their tablets or their iPhones and go shopping around, you know, probably for these conspiracy theorists or whatnot. It was more fun. They don't want to read off the page, or they don't want to listen outstanding, you know, radio programming. You know, it's not in their wheelhouse, and it's pretty damn hard to convince them that it might be good for them to try it out, to give it a chance. When they're in their car, their parents aren't listening to regular radio anymore either. You know, they're listening to Sirius. They have the newest digital technology and dashboards now, I know radio fought like hell with Detroit to get radio included in that new technology, you know.